Chapter 14. Howard, said his wife, quite indignant. Did your mother give you the money? Asked the captain. No, I had it by me, replies Mrs. Walker, with a very knowing look. Walker was more surprised than ever. Have you any more by you? Said he. Mrs. Walker showed him her purse with 2 guineas. That is all, love, she said. And I wish, continued she, you would give me a draft, to pay a whole list of little bills, that have somehow all come in within the last few days. Well, you shall have the check, continued Mr. Walker, and began forthwith to make his toilet, which completed, he rang for Mr. Bendigo, and his bill, and intimated his wish to go home directly. The honored bailiff brought the bill, but with regard to his being free, said it was impossible. How impossible? Said Mrs. Walker, turning very red, and then very pale. Did I not pay just now? So you did, and you've got the reshipped, but there's another detainer against the captain for $150. Eglanton and Mazras, of Bond Street, perfumery for 5 years, you know. You don't mean to say you were such a fool as to pay without asking if there were any more detainers? Roared Walker to his wife. Yes, she was though, chuckled Mr. Bendigo, but she'll know better the next time. And, besides, Captain, what's £150 to you? Though Walker desired nothing so much in the world at that moment as the liberty to knock down his wife, his sense of prudence overcame his desire for justice. If that feeling may be called prudence on his part, which consisted in a strong wish to cheat the bailiff into the idea that E. Walker was an exceedingly respectable and wealthy man. Many worthy persons indulge in this fond notion that they are imposing upon the world, strive to fancy, for instance, that their bankers consider them men of property because they keep a tolerable balance, pay little tradesmen's bills with ostentatious punctuality, and so forth. But the world, let us be pretty sure, is as wise as need be, and guesses our real condition with a marvelous instinct, or learns it with curious skill. The London tradesman is one of the keenest judges of human nature extant, and if a tradesman, how much more a bailiff? In reply to the ironic question, what's £150 to you? Walker, collecting himself, answers, it is an infamous imposition, and I owe the money no more than you do, but, nevertheless, I shall instruct my lawyers to pay it in the course of the morning. Under protest, of course. Oh, of course, said Mr. Bendigo, bowing and quitting the room, and leaving Mrs. Walker to the pleasure of a tete-a-tete with her husband. And now being alone with the partner of his bosom, the worthy gentleman began an address to her which cannot be put down on paper here, because the world is exceedingly squeamish, and does not care to hear the whole truth about rascals, and because the fact is that almost every other word of the captain's speech was a curse, such as would shock the beloved reader were it put in print. Fancy, then, in lieu of the conversation, a scoundrel, disappointed and in a fury, wreaking his brutal revenge upon an amiable woman, who sits trembling and pale, and wondering at this sudden exhibition of wrath. Fancy how he clenches his fists and stands over her, and stamps and screams out curses with a livid face, growing wilder and wilder in his rage, wrenching her hand when she wants to turn away, and only stopping at last, when as he has fallen off the chair in a fainting fit, with a heartbreaking sob that made the Jew boy who was listening at the keyhole turn quite pale and walk away. Well, it is best, perhaps, that such a conversation should not be told at length. At the end of it, when Mr. Walker had his wife lifeless on the floor, he seized a water jug, and poured it over her, which operation pretty soon brought her to herself, and shaking her black ringlets, she looked up once more again timidly into his face, and took his hand, and began to cry. He spoke now in a somewhat softer voice, and let her keep paddling on with his hand as before. He couldn't speak very fiercely to the poor girl in her attitude of defeat, and tenderness, and supplication. or Jenna, said he, your extravagance and carelessness have brought me to ruin, I'm afraid. If you had chosen to have gone to Borowski, a word from you would have made him withdraw the writ, and my property wouldn't have been sacrificed, as it has now been, for nothing. It mayn't be yet too late, however, to retrieve ourselves. This Bill of Eglanton's is a regular conspiracy, I am sure, between Mazras and Bendigo here. You must go to Eglanton, he's an old flame of yours, you know. She dropped his hand. Can't go to Eglanton, after what has passed between us, she said. But Walker's face instantly began to wear a certain look, and she said with a shudder, well, dear, I will go. Who will go to Eglanton, and ask him to take a bill for the amount of this shameful demand at any date, never mind what. Mind, however, to see him alone, and I'm sure, if you choose you can settle the business. Make haste, set off directly, and come back, as there may be more detainers in. Trembling, and in a great flutter, Morgina put on her bonnet and gloves, and went towards the door. "'Tis a fine morning," said Mr. Walker, looking out. "Walk will do you good. And Morgina, didn't you say you had a couple of guineas in your pocket?" "Here it is," said she, smiling all at once, and holding up her face to be kissed. She paid the 2 guineas for the kiss. Was it not a mean act? Is it possible that people can love where they do not respect? Says Miss Prim. I never would. Nobody asked you, Miss Prim. But recollect, Morgina was not born with your advantages of education and breeding, and was, in fact, a poor vulgar creature, who loved Mr. Walker, not because her mama told her, nor because he was an exceedingly eligible and well-brought-up young man, but because she could not help it, and knew no better. Nor is Mrs. Walker set up as a model of virtue. Ah, no. When I want a model of virtue, I will call in Baker Street, and ask for a sitting of my dear, if I may be permitted to say so, Miss Prim. We have Mr. Howard Walker safely housed in Mr. Bendigo's establishment in Cursitor Street, Chancery Lane, and it looks like mockery and want of feeling towards the excellent hero of this story, or, as should rather be said, towards the husband of the heroine, to say what he might have been but for the unlucky little circumstance of Borowski's passion for Morgina. If Bereskai had not fallen in love with Morgina, he would not have given her 200 guineas worth of lessons. He would not have so far presumed as to seize her hand and attempt to kiss it. If he had not attempted to kiss her, she would not have boxed his ears. He would not have taken out the writ against Walker. Walker would have been free, very possibly rich, and therefore certainly respected. He always said that a month's more liberty would have set him beyond the reach of misfortune. The assertion is very likely a correct one, for Walker had a flashy enterprising genius, which ends in wealth sometimes, in the King's Bench not seldom, occasionally, alas, in Van Diemen's Land. He might have been rich, could he have kept his credit, and had not his personal expenses and extravagances pulled him down. He had gallantly availed himself of his wife's fortune, nor could any man in London, as he proudly said, have made £500 go so far. He had, as we have seen, furnished a house, sideboard, and cellar with it. He had a carriage, and horses in his stable, and with the remainder he had purchased shares in 4 companies of 3, of which he was founder and director, had conducted innumerable bargains in the foreign stocks, had lived and entertained sumptuously, and made himself a very considerable income. He had set up the Capital Loan and Life Assurance Company, had discovered the Chimborazo gold mines, and the Society for Recovering and Draining the Ponton Marshes, capital 10 millions, patron His Holiness the Pope. It certainly was stated in an evening paper that His Holiness had made him a Knight of the Spur, and had offered to him the rank of Count, and he was raising a loan for His Highness, the cacique of Panama, who had sent him, by way of dividend, the grand cordon of His Highness's Order of the Castle and Falcon, which might be seen any day at his office in Bond Street, with the parchments signed and sealed by the Grand Master and Falcon King-at-Arms of His Highness. In a week more Walker would have raised £100,000 on His Highness's 20% loan. He would have had £15,000 commission for himself. His companies would have risen to par. He would have realized his shares. He would have gone into Parliament. He would have been made a baronet, who knows? A peer, probably. "And I appeal to you, sir," Walker would say to his friends. "Could any man have shown better proof of his affection for his wife than, by laying out her little miserable money as I did? They call me heartless, sir, because I didn't succeed. Sir, my life has been a series of sacrifices for that woman, such as no man ever performed before." A proof of Walker's dexterity and capability for business may be seen in the fact that he had actually appeased and reconciled one of his bitterest enemies, our honest friend Eglanton. After Walker's marriage, Eglanton, who had now no mercantile dealings with his former agent, became so enraged with him that, as the only means of revenge in his power, he sent him in his bill for goods supplied to the amount of 150 guineas, and sued him for the amount. But Walker stepped boldly over to his enemy, and in the course of half an hour they were friends. Eglanton promised to forego his claim, and accepted in lieu of it £300 shares of the ex-Panama stock, bearing 25%. Payable half yearly at the house of Hocus Brothers, St. Swithin's Lane, £300 shares, and the second class of the Order of the Castle and Falcon, with the ribbon and badge. "And 4 years, Eglanton, my boy, I hope to get you the Grand Cordon of the Order," said Walker. "Hope to see you a Knight Grand Cross, with a grant of 100,000 acres reclaimed from the Isthmus." To do my poor Glanton justice, he did not care for the 100,000 acres. It was the star that delighted him. Ah, how his fat chest heaved with delight as he sewed on the cross and ribbon to his dress coat, and lighted up 4 wax candles, and looked at himself in the glass. He was known to wear a great coat after, that it was that he might wear the cross under it. That year he went on a trip to Bowlin. He was dreadfully ill during the voyage, but as the vessel entered the port he was seen to emerge from the cabin, his coat open, the star blazing on his chest. The soldiers saluted him as he walked the streets. He was called Monsieur Le Chevalier, and when he went home he entered into negotiations with Walker to purchase a commission in His Highness's service. Walker said he would get him the nominal rank of captain. The fees at the Panama War Office were £5.20, which some honest Eglanton produced, and had his commission, and a pack of visiting cards printed as Captain Archibald Eglanton, K.C.C. F. Many a time he looked at them as they lay in his desk, and he kept the cross in his dressing table, and wore it as he shaved every morning. His Highness the Cacique, it is well known, came to England, and had lodgings in Regent Street, where he held a levee, at which Eglanton appeared in the Panama uniform, and was most graciously received by his sovereign. His Highness proposed to make Captain Eglanton his aide-de-camp with the rank of colonel, but the captain's exchequer was rather low at that moment, and the fees at the R office were peremptory. Meanwhile His Highness left Regent Street, was said by some to have returned to Panama, by others to be in his native city of Cork, by others to be leading a life of retirement in the New Cut, Lambeth. At any rate, was not visible for some time, so that Captain Eglanton's advancement did not take place. Eglanton was somehow ashamed to mention his military and chivalric rank to Mr. Mazarus, when that gentleman came into partnership with him, and kept these facts secret until they were detected by a very painful circumstance. On the very day when Walker was arrested at the suit of Benjamin Barosky, there appeared in the newspapers an account of the imprisonment of His Highness the Prince of Panama for a bill owing to a licensed victualler in Ratcliffe Highway. The magistrate to whom the victualler subsequently came to complain passed many pleasantries on the occasion. He asked whether his highness did not drink like a swan with two necks, whether he had brought any bell savages with him from Panama, and so forth. And the whole court, said the report, was convulsed with laughter when Boniface produced a green and yellow ribbon with a large star of the Order of the Castle and Falcon, with which his highness proposed to gratify him, in lieu of paying his little bill. It was as he was reading the above document with a bleeding heart that Mr. Mazarus came in from his daily walk to the city. "L. Eglanton," says he, "have you heard the news about his highness? About your friend Walker, he's arrested for £200. Eglanton at this could contain no more, but told his story of how he had been induced to accept £300 of Panama stock for his account against Walker, and cursed his stars for his folly. "Well, you've only to bring in another bill," said the younger perfumer. "Swear he owes you £150, and we'll have a writ out against him this afternoon." And so a second writ was taken out against Captain Walker. "You'll have his wife here very likely in a day or two," said Mr. Mazarus to his partner. "Them chaps always sends their wives, and I hope you know how to deal with her." "I don't value her a fix hand," said Eglanton. "LL treat her like the dust of the hearth. After that woman's conduct to me, I should like to see her have the audacity to come here. And if she does, you'll see how I'll serve her." The worthy perfumer was, in fact, resolved to be exceedingly hard-hearted in his behavior towards his old love, and acted over at night in bed the scene which was to occur when the meeting should take place. "Oh," thought he, "but it will be a grand thing, to see the proud Morgan on her knees to me, and me a-pointing to the door, and saying, 'Madam, you've steeled this eared against you, you have. Bury the recollection of old times, of those old times, when I thought my earth would have broke, but it didn't know. Earths are made of sterner stuff. I didn't die, as I thought I should. I stood it, and lived to see the woman I despised at my feet, ha, ha, at my feet.'" In the midst of these thoughts Mr. Eglanton fell asleep, but it was evident that the idea of seeing Morgiana once more agitated him considerably, else why should he have been at the pains of preparing so much heroism? His sleep was exceedingly fitful and troubled. He saw Morgiana in 100 shapes. He dreamed that he was dressing her hair, that he was riding with her to Richmond, that the horse turned into a dragon, and Morgiana into Wolsey, who took him by the throat and choked him, while the dragon played the key bugle. And in the morning when Mazarus was gone to his business in the city, and he sat reading the Morning Post in his study, ah! What a thump his heart gave as the lady of his dreams actually stood before him. Many a lady who purchased brushes at Eglanton's shop would have given 10 guineas for such a color as his when he saw her. His heart beat violently, he was almost choking in his stays. He had been prepared for the visit, but his courage failed him now it had come. They were both silent for some minutes. "You know what I am come for," at last said Morgiana from under her veil, but she put it aside as she spoke. "Aye, that is, yes, it's a painful affair, ma'am," he said, giving one look at her pale face, and then turning away in a flurry. "Beg to refer you to Blunt, Hone, and Sharpus, my lawyers, ma'am," he added, collecting himself. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.